Welcome to the DBS Films Podcast, a behind-the-scenes look into making indie films. Learn from DBS Films about their process, tips, and fun stories that all come with making multiple movies a reality.
Hey everybody, welcome to DBS Films Podcast. My name is Kellen, with me as always is my brother Brendan, and together we make movies with DBS Films. So today we're going to go into part two of the scene-by-scene breakdown of The Invited. The Invited was our second movie. You can still take a look at it on Amazon Prime. Be sure to take a look at our Discord channel, guys, DBS Films, because that is the place to be. We make movies for our fans, with our fans. If you want to be part of this amazing process, if you want to have the opportunity to be cast in our movies, you're going to have to go ahead and look at joining in there. So, you know, where we're picking off now, we've kind of mentioned before, you know, a lot of these issues were just generic indie filmmaking issues, not knowing how to do upbeats, having downbeats that dragged, having dialogue that's not very efficient. But, you know, I think the mechanics of it, in the sense of the story, is still there. It's just poorly executed. So, you know, we're halfway through the movie. I think by now most people have turned this off, or you're like, what the heck's going on here? You know what I mean? I think that's just where we're kind of at in the process of, if you are interested, you are probably not interested for the reason we want you to be interested. You're interested in the reason I love it now, which is, I'm just kind of like, dude, what is happening here? What am I watching? And for me, this is something, you know, I think we stressed before, where you can make a good movie, you can make a bad movie, but don't make a boring movie. So what are kind of your thoughts up to this halfway point where we're at now?
Yeah, after watching like thousands of independent horror movies, I would probably turn this movie off right after we had the party scene. Nothing really happens, and we wake up and it's morning again, and we immediately go into two or three different phone calls. This is, if I were watching this for the first time, I had no idea what this movie was, this would be where I would turn the movie off. So, you know, it's one reason to really watch a lot of movies, to number one, hone your craft, see what other people are doing, do it for inspiration. But you kind of get a sixth sense of, you know, where would you turn this movie off? And I think I turn it off right now, which is a shame, because the most important part of the movie is the 30-minute mark, which we should, I think we should be around 30 minutes right now, the halfway point of the movie. And we should be pushing the audience into the second half, the, you know, closer to the climax. There should be, you know, more intensity, more drive. There should be a reason for the audience member to keep watching. And I don't think we have any of that. And we mentioned in the last episode, this is a suspense movie. So you're supposed to be slowly building tension and weird things and, you know, just really building the mystery of the plot. Almost like you're watching a train wreck in slow motion. It needs to get thicker. It needs to get more intense. The stakes need to get higher. And I don't think we have any of that. I think, honestly, the stakes were highest in the intro hook. And from that point, it kind of peaks. And we're just slowly going back down. We don't have enough to hold the viewer, the attention of the viewer. And I think in the data, which, you know, we had, a lot of people turned this movie off, the completion rate was very, very low. And, you know, that was the reason. It's like, we're in the middle of this movie. We should really be catapulting the viewer to the next half of the movie. And, you know, we just completely missed.
Yep, that basically sums it up pretty good. So we are picking up. I think we actually have like three morning scenes where they wake up and just have a phone conversation set up. But basically where we left off, Brad calls Sandy and is essentially like, hey, I'm sorry for last night. You know, my buddy Blake had to drag me out there. Blake's like, come on, this is super weird. Brad's all sad as usual. And then he drives back to the house to meet Dimitri. So Dimitri is our cult leader. And again, you know, I think it looks good when we're in the house and everything there. And like the this is the textbook, like, man, I can't believe we shot the scene this way, which was them walking from the house along the dock, doing the walk and talking. One, incredibly difficult for motion, became super shaky, audio's bad. It looks terrible in the sense that it just looks like they're walking down the sidewalk when you have an amazing house with an amazing deck, or you could just cut right to them on the dock. Like this scene right here is probably my textbook of like execution. And, you know, again, I think the thing is we had the movie done. The crew did a fantastic job. This was just people not knowing and us running out of time. You know what I mean? This was, we got to get this scene done. Where can we shoot it? Let's just shoot it here. And before anyone's saying like, hey, this doesn't really look too good or whatnot, the snowball's there and you're just filming the scene to get the scene done. So that's one of the things that I think a lot of people who watch movies don't understand, that the scene is made through production and there's a lot of limiting factors. And I think we were too far gone at this point and we're like, let's just get them walking and talking. And then before saying, hey, maybe this isn't the best idea, or let's rethink it, it was just too late. But what are your thoughts on the walk and talk?
Yeah, the DP wanted to do this. And I think it just comes back to like, they just didn't have an understanding of what to do. I know we worked on this in pre-production, the actual like walk and how far it was to that dock. You know, walk and talks are great, but man, like if you're outside, you have to have ND filter on there. You have to have a stabilizer, which we didn't have. And we weren't walking like down anything like super nice. It wasn't like a cinematic shot. And I think this is a big time indie problem where you kind of set yourself up to fail. Like this was just a much harder shot than it needed to be. It doesn't add anything to the production. We could easily done this inside the house in an office, which would have been really cool. Nice, easy cinematic location. We could have done it closer on the dock as just, you know, one cut, two cut wide, and it would have been super easy to pull off, and we probably could have focused more on the acting. Instead, we wanted to do like this oneer with motion, and you know, it's shaky as hell. The audio is off, the sky is blown out. We're literally walking down like it's just like a little driveway to get to the dock. There's like air conditioning units, it's not beautiful at all, and we just didn't have enough experience to know this. So this was just an example of just setting ourselves up for failure. And we could have done something much, much easier and made it a lot easier on ourselves. And we didn't. And I see a lot of indie films, you know, they just don't have enough experience to put themselves in a place to succeed. And they actually find them putting themselves in places that are actually going to harm them. And that just all comes from experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest thing. Like nothing was wrong in the moment or doing that or whatnot. And I think this is just the case with a lot of stuff. Like you'll film it in the moment and be like, we got it. Awesome. And, you know, like we always say, it's not until you get to the very final editing process of it where it's like, oh, wow, OK, this is what it's like. And now you understand, let's never do that again, or let's never try and do that. The dialogue also is something very odd here. You know, it's a little bit clunky, forced for it. And, you know, I think it really is something where it's just a highlight of the tactic was there in the sense of what we're using it, the lore dump and all of that stuff. It's just the mismanage of like a little bit of the execution. But back to what it goes back to is you just don't know this until you make a movie. I mean, like this is, we see this all the time in all the indie films that we see, and it is not easy to make a movie. So like, this is just stuff that happens from it. So we have that. And then, you know what, I think one of the best scenes that we have, I think looks wise and just the start of a really epic, you know, appearances in all of our movies, the fire pit. So after this, we cut to them having another party. At first, this was supposed to be, again, a grander party and things like that. We were already running out of schedule. I think that's kind of a big one to cut it down to. But then we kind of were like, hey, let's tone it back. And I think this is a textbook example of what you can do. I mean, this is a very well done scene, a little bit of graphical overlay, but I think, like, you know, this is you get the first example of why fire is just such a good source of light. But I think this is probably one of our best scenes in the movie is the fire pit.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think this is where making movies is what we always recommend, because you find little gems, you know, for as wacky as this movie is, and, you know, we did a lot of things wrong, you find some shining light, and this is that scene. This scene has, you know, fire. It looks great. So we know next time to always try and use fire pit scenes in our movies. Having the group around there looked really cool. I thought the dialogue was cool. It was engaging when they're passing around the cup. The pool looks great in the background with its blue like lights. And, you know, I think this movie or this scene just turned out really, really well. So this would be an example of when we uploaded this movie, we looked at, all right, you know, what do we do well? What did we, you know, need to improve on? And this was a scene, honestly, if we were to remake this movie, I would keep the scene and just amp it up, do it better, shoot it better. But for the most part, very engaging. It's probably our most cinematic scene in the whole movie. And, you know, with just fire and having the cool element of like the drug cup being passed around, it's just a cool little scene. And I was very happy with how it turned out.
Yeah, I really agree. You know, the drink of unity, a great scene as well, too. You know, it's kind of our way of progressing the plot and having them agree to it. So then we cut to, this is something that you've heard us talk about so often as like an example of just being on set and set time and how like time can eat up. We cut to him waking up again. So it's been, you know, this guy's woken up three times now in this movie. Let's see, I'm timing out there. So 33 minutes and 14 seconds all the way to, so 43 seconds is him waking up and then going down the stairs, and then we hard cut to him at the office. The reason we bring this up is this scene, I think, took us about 3 hours to get. And it just is one of those things that I think can happen on a film set when you're looking for a certain look or you get bogged down with something there. But now that would take us, not only would that probably take us maybe 45 minutes total, 30 to 45 minutes, but we'd probably have like triple the footage. And I think it just comes down to, this is something that you don't understand unless you're behind the scenes in the process, where there's so much that goes into every single scene to get it there. And it's much more than, is the scene good or bad? Obviously you want it to be good, but you know, when the scene not only isn't usable, but it takes up so much time, there's a lot of stuff you'll film that never sees the light of day. And at that point in time, this is one of the biggest things that I think indie filmmakers need to watch out. So I just want to highlight that brief scene of him waking up, talking to Sandy briefly, and then going down the stairs, because that is how you can kind of trap yourself in production. And I think one of the other bigger issues is, this was at the very beginning of the shoot when we didn't necessarily have that time crunch feeling, which I think helped us push forward. And you have to get to the point where we gotta, not only do you need to get the scene, but you need to get the scene done quick.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think this is one of the benefits if you are directing movies, if you can actually work with the camera and you don't need to shoot your own movies, because obviously spending time with the actors is crucial. But from what I've seen, you know, having an understanding of camera, having an understanding of editing, and having an understanding of directing is like the trifecta that you really need to just, you know, make sure you have a smooth production. And I think that this is a transition scene. This scene has no bearing on the overall plot. And it took 3 or 4 hours, which is just inexcusable. And I think, you know, if I were working with someone else, I'd be like, look, this is a transition scene. The only thing that I want from this scene is that he overslept and he's being kind of awoken by this fact that he has to go back to work. So he's being thrust back into his other job, which for the night he completely forgot existed. He was having such a good time, he totally forgot that he actually had to go to work. And the only emotion that I would want from this is that he's frantic and that he's late and he's frantic. So if I were to shoot this, I would just do wides of him running down the steps and out the door. That's it. Like, put him on the tripod or do a shoulder rig with a pan, get a little bit of motion, two cuts, get him running down the steps, like almost like falling over, and then running out the door. That's all we need. And having that knowledge and understanding how to do that, now I can communicate that to a DP, and we get this done in 15 minutes as opposed to 3 hours. But because I didn't have experience before, I wasn't able to properly communicate that. And the DP, sometimes they get like the shots in their head that they really want to make look good for whatever reason. And like the DP just liked this guy coming down these cool steps, but it's a transition shot. You can cut this shot out of the whole movie and just have him back at his office, and it does nothing to the movie. So you have to kind of pick your battles, understand where you need to put your time and your focus, and also understand like, you know, what your motivations are as far as like, why are you doing this scene? And you got to kind of stick to this, and this could have probably been solved a little bit more in pre-production. But again, my communication probably could have been better as well.
Yeah, I mean, you really just don't even understand at this point in time. And I think the biggest thing is that something got made, you know, that because you see it all the time in indie filmmaker, and now it's easy to go back and say, well, yeah, we do it like this, but that's experience. So we cut back to the office, and, you know, he's on his phone. He's like, what are you texting? Get back to work, Curtis, which I it's pretty funny to me. But this causes Curtis to finally snap because he had an offer from Dimitri. Again, I like the offer. I think that's a great plot point. You know, hey, I'll start your business. I feel like everyone has a side hustle, and I think it's very relatable. So that's a really good one. This is kind of the pushing point. You know, we mentioned in part one, we really amp up the office setting. I know one time when we were talking about, we were thinking like almost like that Fight Club type look, where like you can make it really gritty and like just really, really like harsh in that office vibe, especially if you have kind of a more intense boss. So I think we're seeing just a little brief idea here, which is basically Curtis gets pushed too far. He goes into his boss's office. He's like, I quit. And then he walks home. And then, you know, we have another phone call with Curtis with Blake to kind of push it. So, you know, I think the dynamic of the office and the concept of the scene, once again, you know, as textbook has been this entire movie, great concept, poorly executed. You know, I would have had him do some ridiculous stuff. You know, everyone imagines quitting the office. Like if I had this one, I'd have him go completely, like just make a massive scene in the office calling out the jerk of the boss that everyone hates. You know, I think you can make that a real triumphant scene that everyone enjoys. And we just kind of did it really brief and got him out of there, and then immediately got him onto a phone call so he can progress the story. So what, I think it's kind of just the same thing that we've been mentioning the past sections of it.
Yeah, I think this has to be Curtis's like final, like, I'm going to the cult. This is like his downfall, essentially. He's like, listen, I'm going to do this. And he has to have like a giant action scene. And I think that the whole problem with this whole movie is everything's flat and it doesn't hit very hard. I completely agree. I think that you have him freak out, make a huge scene to the point where he can never come back to that job, that it might even hurt his career if that boss is like, I'm going to tell everyone like what you're doing. You'll never work in this town again, boy. And, you know, you can have some kind of crazy thing like that. And, you know, I think that's what it needed to have. He needed to like throw his old life away or just essentially light it on fire. And that act puts him into the cult. And then he's kind of like trapped by like whatever's going to happen next. So it becomes like a bigger, you know, just a bigger commitment to him. And I think that sets up the climax much more because there's more stakes, there's more tension. You know, we're making a thriller movie. Like all of a sudden it went from like 0 to 100 where, you know, he was 1 foot in, 1 foot out, and now he's just fully committed to this cult. So I think that that's the scene that needed to happen. It needed to be very intense. It needed to be essentially Curtis saying, look, I'm in this for the long haul. I don't care about my old life. This is my new life.
Yeah, I really do, you know, think that this is the peak moment there, kind of solidifying it. He goes over the edge. So he goes back to the mansion. Sandy's there. And again, I love this movie so much. I can watch this movie a million times because of how the little things just stand out to me. He walks in and they all start clapping. I love that so much. It's just great. So they're all there. They welcome him. Come on, sit down. Let's go ahead. Have a glass of wine. Meet me out back. I love Dimitri's pose where he's just chilling with the slight shades on. He's like, you're not going to turn down a $300 glass of Chardonnay. So basically he comes back and he immediately gets drugged. This is one of my more sad moments of DVS just because I was in the scene. I thought it would have been really cool. And I was looking forward to it, you know, first time being on camera to have some screen time. we had me go up with like a bag and put it over his head. And like, that's one of the brief action points that we had. And that's so critical, but I think we lost the cut or something, or it was broken or something happened. And now you just fade out after he takes the wine and like, oh man, we miss on literally every single high beat. And the one time we have one that actually can justify it, because you have two people sneak up and put a hood on him. That's a good hard cut. That's really good stuff to do. We miss the footage. I think it's a testament to indie filmmaking. And like, my favorite thing now when I watch indie, well, not favorite thing, but when I watch indie filmmaking, you see kind of a scene, you almost kind of get a gut feeling of like something probably happened in post.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. This was not a good thing. This would be the second movie in a row that we had some issues with footage. And honestly, as a DP and with a lot of our other movies, we never had these problems. So I don't know. It just seemed to be like the first two movies that we had a lot of problems with it. We had a really cool bag scene. I know we had 7 or 8 takes of this, and all of them were missing or corrupted. So I don't know, like, if something's wrong with the memory card. I can't remember the specifics, but they were just gone and we had to move on. But I mean, it's like one reason to have an on-set editor, because Kel could have been there and been like, hey man, the footage is gone with the bag scene. We just redo it. It doesn't take long to redo that scene, but it was a crucial scene because he's essentially being betrayed by the cult that he essentially threw everything away to join. And not having that, having just a little, you know, shitty fade out is just not ideal. So I mean, it is what it is, but I think, you know, you got to be careful. If you're the DP, you got to really be making sure that your stuff is like getting on that card and it is working. Even now, I still go back and I'll do spot checks whenever we, you know, change scenes, just to make sure that the card's recording properly. So, you know, you want to make sure you have all your, you know, your checks and balances to make sure, because things do happen, but we really haven't seen a problem like that ever. And now we have systems in place to avoid that. But I don't know, like, if I think this scene needs to be amped up. And I think that it honestly happens probably too soon. I think that Curtis should have been like involved in the ceremony a little bit more, and things just started to get weirder and weirder and weirder and weirder until he like maybe tries to actually back out, and then they drug him and take him. I think it was just such a quick thing where it's like, oh, welcome Curtis, here you go. Oh, we're drugging you and taking you. So it really was more is a passive decision. Curtis wasn't like the active participant in there. And I think that is such a character-driven movie where he's making all these mistakes. He just made a huge commitment to this cult by, you know, quitting his job and essentially destroying his career. And for him to just come in there and just have something happen to him, and he's not the active person driving this decision even further into like the bad news territory. As a story, I think I have like a problem with that.
Yeah, no, and I think it's, again, we kind of expected to have more stuff in between, and like when we were cutting it down, I think that probably is why it moves quick. But yeah, 100% agree. I mean, it goes from hey, welcome to hey, you're done for. Then you cut to Blake. So it literally, we missed the bag. You cut to Blake. He's doing some research. He's like, hey, take a look, I found something suspicious here. You introduce his girlfriend or fiance or whoever, which just is textbook. You don't need a character, but you know, hey, this is us making characters. He goes, he puts his hat on, he gets his gun, he's ready to go. And, you know, honestly, that's pretty standard. I don't think we really need to talk about it too much, but it just kind of shows you, hey, it's good to progress the ones there. And then here's the thing, from the 43 minute to the rest of the movie, I think we absolutely nailed the ending. The execution on the ending was by far, for how poorly we handled the execution in the beginning, the execution on the ending is amazing. I mean, it's one of our best climaxes, and this movie rolls. And it's just a shame that you have to get 43 minutes into this thing before you really get some tension, which is him waking up drugged, you know, and it from that point on, it goes really good. So do you want to quickly talk about why this is probably the worst formula to have? in a movie just nowadays in order to get people to continue watching it, where you really want to hit home in that first intro and that first building there. But again, you know, we always say the climax is important because that's the last, you know, taste they have in their mouth. So if they're going to go ahead and review it, they're going to remember that climax. But do you want to talk about why that pacing is just so critical for any movie?
Yeah, I think it's, if you're doing a mystery or a thriller as an indie film studio and this is your first movie, it's going to be tough. It's just very difficult to keep people's attention because you have to hit, I mean, you're literally walking on like a tightrope. It's like you're wobbling, you're moving, and you're just trying to keep like everyone's focus and vision moving forward. And if you don't have that experience, you're going to fall off. It's just what's going to happen. And you can have a really cool ending. You can have a really cool climax, which is honestly where I think a lot of thriller and suspense movies start, is the writer will come up with the ending and they'll work backwards. And I think that's absolutely fine. I think that's how we started The Invited, if I remember correctly. It was a concept and we started with the end and moved forward or moved backwards. The problem is that like, you have to make sure people get to your really cool ending. And I think The Invited suffer from that. But I do think, you know, having a chase scene, this climax is similar to what we did in a lot of our movies. In Girl and Cabin 13, it's a similar climax. We do it, the chase climax, very, very well. It's very, very easy to shoot. And it just comes down to editing. And I think that a lot of indie filmmakers, if you're doing horror movies or you're doing suspense movies, having a climax where they're running away from something at the end and it's chasing them and you have multiple cut points is your bread and butter. And it just makes for a very easy climax where you can kind of focus on like the final last minutes of your movie. There's tension, there's dread, there's, you can pace it out properly. And I would highly recommend it because it just works. And the fact that she took him and started running through the forest, and, you know, we had Blake in there, they were cutting back to, and we had the cult that was like kind of after them as well, just had a lot of good tension. And it is a shame that a lot of people didn't get to see this because, yes, this climax is still very rushed. It actually works pretty well, though. And I think we did a pretty good job for like our budget and our experience level at the time.
Yeah, I you know, think it's just critical example of why you just need the experience to do it. So hopping in detail for the climax itself, you know, we get Curtis walking around the house, aggressive movement, you know, you're kind of establishing that. This is, we also start doing something that we talk about now more and more, which is really good, is having the dual cut points. So you have Curtis and Sandy running through the woods and you have Blake running around the house. So you can kind of chop it up there. I'd say we'd probably chop it up even more now that I'm looking at it right now. But that's a good way. You have action there. Anytime you're getting people running and moving, you know, that's always going to increase the pacing there. Do you want to talk about just real briefly, you know, if you have a scene like this where you're moving them, what you can kind of learn from like frantic pacing? I think in The Murder House, we do it very well. When things get to this critical point of after the seizure, you're really kind of just moving forward and how having movement on and off and just kind of talking. Now, again, that's going to make it harder to film, but being able to cut between two different clips with people running is just going to have natural movement in it versus the static cam.
Yeah, I would definitely, if you're doing like one of these climaxes, or just really in any climax, I would have three cut points. I'd have your main character is trying to get away. You have the threat that's actively chasing them. And then you have the help that's like their last ditch effort to try and, you know, save them. Cutting between all three of these is great for editing because you're cutting the main characters, you can cut them quick and you can keep that frantic pace. You have the villain or the, you know, the threat coming after them. So you're reminding the viewer that they're in danger, the stakes are still there. And then you have the help coming, which helps you like with the time element of your movie. Like time is ticking away. This guy needs to come, this guy or girl needs to come and help them. And I think that this is the way to do it. And I'm always going to try and do this in all my climaxes. If you watch a lot of Hollywood movies, this is what they do. when they do Abisa's work, it works and it's very easy to do. I mean, I just finished editing the second pass through the Shapeshifter movie, and that's what we did. We had, you know, two characters running away, one character chasing them, and we had help on the way. And it's just so much easier to edit. It just comes down to like, all right, can we get the pacing to feel proper? So I think it works. It's a neat little indie trick. And no matter what my movies are, even if they're not like these crazy runaway movies where they're like running in the woods or really trying to get away from a location, I'd still try and have three cut points because I think it just makes for a better movie. And it just helps you really pace out that climax to make it, you know, as good as you possibly can make it.
Yeah. So really, you know, having those cut points and everything that you mentioned is just critical because it allows you to have that flexibility in the pacing. One thing that I really enjoy, you know, about this, and I think this is what you're talking about, where you kind of work in reverse with a thriller. This was the twist that I was always like, oh, I can't wait for this, because we kind of make it seem like, you know, maybe Sandy really cares for him. You know, she's trying to save him, you know, adding him, bring him here. And then she leads them to the cult. And I mean, production value is one thing. You know, if you haven't seen The Invited, it's really hard to just describe what you see. I love it. I think it's fantastic with us wearing our animal mask and so on and so forth. But I think it's actually a good reveal. And you know, it's fire scene too. Like for what we actually had with, I mean, I'm looking at the goat right now. It's ridiculous. The goat one in the corner, like the two of the masks are pretty good. And then the deer one's kind of off there, but you know what? It actually doesn't look that bad and it looks good. Why? It's at night, it's in the woods and there's a fire. And those are just fantastic elements. And I mean, like, can you imagine if you just had these people in a house or something like that? It'd be a ridiculous reveal, but you have the fire, you have that natural light to it. And I think it works pretty good. You know, it's a quick little dialogue scene here. Two things I want to talk about. One, the look and how that looks good. And then two, the absolute nightmare that it is to film in a woods, especially that one was.
I mean, it looks good. It's kind of cheap. It's kind of hokey. And because you just not our budget. Like our budget was low for this one. But I thought we executed the general concept. I think there's two reasons why this doesn't work. The first is obviously our budget that I mentioned before, that on a technical level, we didn't shoot it properly. It could have had a lot more impact. The second thing is Sandy and Curtis's relationship was never developed. You never felt like she really, really liked him or he really, really liked her. And the problem is that betrayal doesn't really sting because it's like, well, you know, she was just using him. It's very flat. Their relationship is very flat. So that comes back to, we really needed to spend probably 20 more minutes building the relationship. We needed to pull elements of like a romance movie to really make it seem like they love each other, or at least they're really falling in love. And their love is like the main thing, and the cult is like the thing that's separating them. And I think we never really pulled that off, because if you do that, then the reveal is much more painful for Brad or for Curtis. And I think it's a lot more impactful where it's like, man, I really thought that she liked him and that this cult was just kind of a thing that she kind of got trapped up in, and that they're both going to kind of escape it and go live like whatever new life they wanted to live. And that just never came across in this movie. We never spent enough time developing their characters. Their dialogue was very one-off. It was a very Curtis-centric movie. So you never really get her emotion or her point of view on anything. So when you do have this reveal, it's just not impactful at all.
Yeah, it really is the case where, you know, I even thought this could be one that might potentially be a series where you can actually play that out more. Didn't have that done. I mean, the character, yeah, execution there, but the whole concept, the twist and everything, I think is actually still really, really good, like outline and frame. We just, like you said, need to, you know, figure out how to execute on that. And then from there, fantastic job, honestly. I mean, you have, they run away slightly. You have a little knife combat scene, which looks really good. You know, even though Sandy is like 1/10 the size of Brad, it still plays, in my opinion. You know, maybe he's still drugged up. There's a chase, there's dialogue, there's knife, there's a gunshot from Curtis or from Blake shooting Sandy, and then you, because you stood it as Dimitri, come up there and you shank him in the back. And then there's a little final scene, and then there's a squib shot, and then there's a fadeaway. And I mean, like, this, honestly, like, you look at the Devil in the Room climax. I would say Morgan State's a bit better, but like, I would say until Cabin 13, this is probably our best climax of the Hateful Eight. And that's saying something, because this was our second movie. So I think the climax, we did a fantastic job. But again, that climax was absolutely a nightmare to film.
Yeah, I mean, it's so good because we devoted a whole day to it, or 32 hours to be exact. So the reason it's good is, like, we just never got all this stuff done. We had to do a giant pickup day. At any time, you have to just sit there and you're like, all right, well, you know, we're going to do this. It's going to be eight minutes of footage. We're going to film it for the whole day, and this is all we have to focus on. It's going to be really good. I mean, that's what we did in Girl in Cabin 13, where we knew we only had, you know, that whole night just focused on that one climax. If we had to push this to the actual principal shooting, it probably would have been much more watered down and it wouldn't have been as good. That being said, if we just had them running around a little bit longer and added a little bit more meat to this, this climax would have been really, really good. I thought the gunshot looked good. I thought the stab looked good. It needed a little bit more combat in there. But for the most part, like, it was a pretty good climax. I think you just needed to have them, or Brad running away and Sandy chasing him with Dimitri, like, going back to, you know, what I said before, having, you know, Curtis running away, the cult members after him, him hiding from the cult members a little bit more, and then Blake, like, running through the woods. So when he does show up to shoot them, it's not as jarring, like, you know, he's coming. And I think just adding, like, this is the meat and bones. This is the really good part of this movie. You know, we should have had more footage, and I would have loved to extend it, to pace it a little bit more, because it is very, very quick. We just didn't have the coverage to do so.
Yeah, I mean, it is something where, again, looking at it where we're at now, it is something there's a lot you can improve upon. But for the second film and where it was at, I think it's a really, really solid, you know, climax, as you were saying. And with that wrapping up the movie, I kind of want to see, so, you know, in the first one, we talked about what we would do with the scene, you know, halfway up to the movie. So kind of from that halfway point, you know, I think you have to go big on the office scene. That needs to be a massive explosion. I think you probably have another party scene, and maybe Blake comes back and there's a big confrontation between Blake and the cult there, but it's not so life and death situation. That when he kind of solidifies, yeah, I'm done with work, but I'm also done with you. And, you know, you really have 2 points of cutting it off. That can be like a cool art or altercation there. And then from there, you know, I think it's, you can go a lot of different ways with, like, how he actually gets hunted. I think you probably do, like, maybe like a big ceremony or something like that. The way that I liked it to end was, and this was my favorite, because we went back and forth with a lot of them, I would have it where he's not necessarily hunted. I would just have it where, like, there's some type of climax or something like that. It would kind of pull away from that, but I would love it to where he has to make the decision to sacrifice Curtis, or to have to sacrifice his buddy Blake. So he actually, not only because of what happened with Blake trying to get him, Blake gets captured. And then because of it, you actually have Curtis kill Blake. And then the only reason I like that is because one of my favorite types of cuts is that little, you know, twist hook at the end. And the way that I would have it is, then you cut to Curtis meeting someone on social media, like Sandy did, showing that he's now fully part of the cult and this is his new life. That was my little take on the ending. Again, the cool thing with endings, especially in concepts like this, there's so many. I think each one of our movies probably for the most part has like 3 or 4 ways you can kind of go until we solidify it. I think this one has some of the most different ways you can go, because there's just a lot you can do with it. But from that halfway point, how would you kind of adjust or change the plot if we had another crack at it?
I mean, I agree. I think, you know, he needs to quit his work, and that needs to be a big scene, because that's like his past life that he's throwing out, all his career. Like, especially if we build him up as a very career-oriented person, like, he's very nervous about his place in corporate America. And then for him to just throw it all out would be a very impactful scene. And I think he goes right back to the cult because they're welcoming him in. And then you have Blake come back who, you know, finds out that he made this huge scene. He goes to the cult and there's like a huge altercation. They throw Blake out, but they really don't throw him out. They capture him at that point. And then I think, like, going back to what I said before, I think Curtis needs to be there for the final ceremony. And I don't think they should necessarily, like, capture him and kidnap him, but it needs to be like almost like his own doing, where he's like actively taking these drugs and stuff. And it becomes clear that he's going to be the hunter at this point. And it's not really clear like what he's hunting. And then you can have the dynamic where you have something like a betrayal with Sandy could still be in there, where he's like in too far, you know, in too deep. But I think you just got to work it in there, where I do agree. I think if you, and we did have the ending where he killed Blake, like that was it, where he was in the original script, he was stabbed, or he finally kills the thing that he's after and pulls back the mask and it's Blake. And I think we actually did have him sitting back in the lodge again. The problem was we were really caught up on the Sandy reveal that she had betrayed him. And I think at this point, you have to kind of figure out what you want. What's more impactful? Him killing his friend accidentally, essentially, without knowing and committing this kind of crazy crime, or the Sandy relationship where she betrays him? And I think just on a story structure way, the Blake one's a little bit more impactful. I think it gets a better, better story, unless you really have a lot of good chemistry with Sandy and Curtis. And then the revisit one. So I think there's two different movies in there. There might be the possibility of merging both of those things in there, but it might be a little bit too much. You might not be able to develop it properly. But I mean, this is why you make movies, is because we made this movie and now all of a sudden there's different ways to go. There's different, you know, paths that this movie could become. And your job when you're making the second version is to choose another path or just make the one you chose better. And it may take 3 or 4 versions to actually get the really best concept out of this movie. But I mean, that's the fun of filmmaking. That's the organic stuff that comes through when you actually upload these things. You get fan feedback and you get, you know, the opportunity to watch it as a fan of this movie, where I could be like, all right, look, we completed this movie. It's completely done. You know, let me take off my director hat and let me watch this as a horror movie fan, a suspense movie fan, and just really give my own honest feedback. And the feedback is, it was an ambitious attempt, but we just didn't have the, you know, the skills to pull it off. It felt like a very watered down version of a movie that could be actually pretty good.
Yeah, I think we took a big swing and just missed it. That being said, though, again, like, I mean, how do we not have like the house or like the production value of it? Like, it really did barely hold up in the sense of like, for how poorly a lot of the stuff was executed on, it's really surprising, because again, you know, it, when you look at The Unseen, which is going to be our next movie, you know, you see us pull back from this, but I think you see the other glaring issues where, you know, had we made the same mistakes in execution on this one as we did for The Unseen, you might get like a worst of both worlds, in the sense of there's a lot to say about having different locations, more characters, things that just make it interesting just staring at the location itself. So I think that was one thing that always stands out to me with The Invited, is really the assets carried it. And I'm just curious to get kind of your little feedback on this, because we will always preach to keep your budgets as small as possible, keep your within your limits and your means. But I think, you know, especially now, almost kind of, especially when I point to like the murder house, I feel like, because it looks the same a lot, there is a benefit from having nice assets. I think, you know, it's obvious in the sense of, you know, seeing it, but I think this is just a good thing to bring up. Be strategic with what you have. And a lot of people will look to get an asset, and then like we talked about here, you can't execute on it. So there's a balance to it.
Yeah, I think for, you know, indie filmmakers, if you're doing your first couple movies or your 1.0 version of the movies, I wouldn't worry about your assets. Honestly, I'd really just worry about telling a good story and really trying to figure out and honing your story and the screenplay and just getting a final product uploaded so you get feedback on it. I think this is a great example of, we did have a bigger budget for this. We had multiple locations. We had a lot of actors and we just completely missed on it. Where you had a movie, the next one, The Unseen, did much, much, much better with a lot less assets, just because you have to have the skill level to be able to actually utilize that stuff. Now, if I was doing The Invited 2.0, I feel much more comfortable having these crazy assets and, you know, giving it more budget and having more locations, because yes, it does help. It helps tremendously, because I think a lot of indie filmmakers, when you're looking at reviews, people will give you a low star rating, but they can't really explain why they're giving you this rating. And when you start to see these reviews pop up, usually in my mind, my working theory is that all the small things of a Hollywood movie add up. And that's what they're realizing, that this movie just doesn't have those things. And it kind of messes with their brain and they can't articulate why this movie looks low budget. Well, it looks low budget because it only has like a few locations. You don't have a set designer. You don't have a costume decorator. You don't have like all this stuff, these small little things that are kind of like almost like subliminal in most Hollywood movies, that you can just see this kind of like set decoration kind of stuff. And indie films just don't have access to that. So I think it does help. I think it helps a lot, but you have to be at the skill level in order to pull that off. And I still think story is king. I think acting is king. And I think that until you can master those two things and really have a good story and have a really good smooth production, that having all these assets and, you know, locations and, you know, set designs aren't going to help you out, because all locations and sets will not mask a, you know, horrible story or boring story, or one that's missing beats. So that's just my philosophy. I see it a lot in indie films where they have a larger budget and they have a ton of really cool sets and locations and special effects, but the overall story is just very amateur and you can tell that they didn't have a lot of reps. And it's much easier to keep your expenses low and get your money back than have to go back and try and get 500K from, you know, streaming platforms that are paying you literally pennies.
Yeah, it's definitely the landscape. But to me, it's something, you know, like I was saying, that stands out and there's a benefit to it. So it's all about being strategic, as always, when it comes to the process. And as an indie filmmaker, you know, one of the best things you can do is just get something done. So this was our second film, The Invited. Like we've said before, it's a great story. I think it's one that, like, of anything, this is one that I cannot wait to remake. I mean, this one's so much fun. I absolutely love the concept. I can't wait to write it. All of those things, like, it's just really, really exciting to me. I also know it's probably going to be a little bit of a wait before we end up deciding to tackle this one. But again, really great to go back, take a look scene by scene. In our next episodes, we're going to go ahead and cover our third movie, which is The Unseen. And I'm really excited for that one because, you know, that was our first real idea of what a horror movie is in the sense of pacing and genre. You know, this one was more of that thriller. Gone was more of just you know, experimental, figuring out what we're doing type thing. So I'm excited for that one. Be sure to go ahead, take a look at our Discord channel online. We also have The Haunting of the Murder House, which is on Amazon. Be sure to give it a rent and review. But until then, have yourselves a good one.